From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. And today, we're bringing back two of our favorite economics analysts. Rana Faruhar is global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times. Rana, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
And Michelle Singletary, nationally syndicated personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. Michelle, welcome back to you as well.
Oh, I'm so glad to be back.
This is becoming a regular thing with us. This is our third meeting in 3 months. So I just want to just give people a little recap here, because when we first talked with both of you at the beginning of this pandemic crisis in March, obviously, the beginnings of this reckoning was happening. And then 6 weeks later, we had you both back on again. And at that point in time, 26 million Americans had filed for unemployment. And now it's 6 weeks after that, and the number is up to 44 million Americans. That's just one of the things I want to talk with you both about. But Michelle, can I just start with you quickly? Like, how do you wrap your head around that number?
You don't. And we shouldn't, because if we try to wrap our head around it, we dismiss it, or we think, oh, that's just them over there. But now we all know that when so many people are unemployed, it impacts us all. Somebody you know has lost their job, or have to piece together part-time jobs to make ends meet. And so I am actually trying not to just make it to normalize this, because we get these reports and it's just something. Oh, it's just another, you know, 12 million people unemployed. And we have to stop and think, that is our neighbor. That is someone down the street. That's someone in the next state. And so I'm trying not to normalize it.
Yeah. Rana?
You know, I think that's a really important point. And I think that there has been this risk of normalization of what are, let's just be clear, what are Great Depression era unemployment numbers? I mean, we haven't seen this kind of a crisis in 100 years. I mean, this is a once in a lifetime kind of crisis. I think that we've all been, or many of us have been hoping, okay, if we can just get through this wave of the virus, if we can just get to the summer, if we can get to reopening, things are going to be okay. But we're already beginning to see now that they're not going to be okay, that this is a longer term thing. This is a marathon we are running. We are very likely going to have a second wave of the virus that is undoubtedly going to have massive economic implications. You know, the last time we spoke, I was looking at this as we've got to run a marathon for a year. I'm now thinking this is more of a 2-year process. From a market standpoint and from an economic standpoint, I'm thinking of the spring of 2022 as, okay, whew, we can finally maybe breathe a sigh of relief. The worst is not done yet, for sure.
2022?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because I think we're going to see two, if not three, waves of the virus. We can get into that later if you want.
Right. Okay. And then remember, you two are two of my favorite guests, so feel free to talk to each other. It's like a three-way hosting thing here going on. Go ahead, Michelle.
I'm so glad she made that. Rhonda, did you made that point, because we have gotten into, and the reason why I said normalizing, because, you know, not regardless of what's happening this week with the stock market, but the market started to go up and people like, okay, we're back. And so, but there's a disconnect between how the market is responding and what's going to happen in real time reality in terms of all those folks who have lost their jobs.
Right.
Some of them won't go back to jobs, or they will, maybe they had a full-time job and then they've got to piece together two or three jobs. So there might be folks listening thinking, well, I'm okay. My portfolio, it's not back 100%, but it's still pretty, it's up. And I can just breathe. But just like with the virus, we've got to remember that this is not over yet. And even if you're okay, your portfolio is starting to come back again. Things are a little crazy right now because there are more cases coming up. But we saw that the market, as soon as it sees that the cases are coming down or there's something happening, it responds differently. But that does not mean that we are out of the woods.
No, and there's also, I'm going to jump in and just say that there's also this disconnect, which you and I have spoken about so many times, about Wall Street and Main Street. You know, about 80-90% of the equity stock in this country is owned by about 10% of the population. So Wall Street going up is great for the top 10%. It does not change the on-the-ground story. It does not change the fact that, you know, one in five Americans have filed for unemployment. It does not change the fact that some new economic Bureau of Economic Research data indicates that maybe 40% of jobs layoffs are, we're not going to get those jobs back. These are big, big structural shifts.
And, you know, on top of that, we have, and this is the thing that I keep coming back to, we have what I think we're undergoing this systemic reckoning over and over and over again about fundamental inequities in American life that are being revealed in almost every system that we could point to, right? And so, so of course, the protests that have been happening in cities across the United States is that too about the inequities, the racial injustices that are happening in the United States that we see on the streets. We see it in terms of financial well-being as well. And so you can't look away anymore. Some people never could to begin with because they were living with those inequities. Mm. But we as a nation cannot and must not look away anymore. And I wonder what you both think about that.
I agree. Go ahead, Rhonda.
No, you go ahead, Michelle, and then I'll take
it. I just wrote a column for this weekend about that very point. The protesters are not just protesting about police brutality. They're looking at the pay gaps, the lack of access to jobs. We still see studies after studies that show that when two job applicants go in with similar resumes, that the white applicants are called back for an interview and blacks are not. And now I wrote about home ownership, which is where most Americans have their wealth, and the disparity in home ownership among African Americans when you compare it to white Americans, and also the ability to build up equity, which people use in times like this to sustain themselves or to tap so that they can keep going. And, you know, I think, I think it's just astounding that we are in 2020. And the rate of Black ownership is near the same level as when race-based housing discrimination was legal. How is that possible?
It's interesting. You know, you and I are, we're definitely having a brain meld here because I wrote my column for this morning on Black Lives Matter and what the synergy is between racial justice and economic justice. And one of the things I've been very fascinated by in the movement, and my daughter's very involved in the protests in Brooklyn. And so I've kind of been watching this both from a macro and a micro perspective in my household. There is an interesting confluence of issues. Some of the issues are very specific for the Black community, but some of them are broader: student debt, wage inequity. And I had a fascinating conversation recently with Bill Spriggs, who's the chief economist of the AFL-CIO, and he was pointing out a couple of interesting statistics to me. Student debt is it's an issue across the country for a broad swath of folks, but it's particularly an issue for the African-American community because young poor Black Americans are more likely than poor white Americans to try and complete that four-year college degree because it is the only way that they can climb up the pay ladder. And it's interesting. He said to me that the pre and post COVID, the unemployment rate for whites that drop out of high school is the same as the Black community overall. Huh. So think about that. I mean, think about that gap. You know, so here's a young African-American person wants to go to college, knows that's the only way up, spends all the money that you have to spend, comes out with an average of $30,000 in college loan debt. And that's just an average. I mean, a lot of people come out with much more than that. Think about the pressure that that is putting, not just on this group, but on the entire economy. You have an entire generation of people that cannot become consumers because they're so burdened by debt. So I think all of this is coming together in this broader movement. I think this is going to be a movement ultimately, not just for racial justice, but for economic justice. I think it might even be a new kind of labor movement.
What do you think, Michelle?
I we're sisters in the struggle, because this is so true. I mean, we've been banging this drum for so long. I mean, if you, in my columns, I've been doing this for so long about the burden of student loan debt and education at any cost and how we've been pushing these. And the thing about African-Americans, when we take on student loan debt, we end up with the debt and no degree. Whereas white Americans at least have the debt and a degree. And that is just so disheartening to me. And I just hope that we don't let this go, because we know that having a degree pushes you up. But with the African-American community, it's not just your nuclear family. It's your extended family. So that when I got my college degree, it helped me lift up other folks in my neighborhood, because studies have shown, Charles Schwab and Ariel Mutual Fund Company in Chicago used to do these studies every year that looked at why weren't Blacks in the stock market and why weren't they doing this? And they looked at it and found that we were twice as likely as to be helping extended family members economically. So that means that extra money you couldn't put in the market because you were helping auntie or grandma at twice the rate of white Americans. And so when I got my degree, you know, I helped my brother with a down payment for his home. I helped his daughter go to school for the first year. So my husband and I paid her to tuition and room and board so that we wouldn't have yet another member in our family not get a college degree.
Wow. Well, you know, we're going to have to take a really quick break here. And I'm thinking about how this confluence of social and economic justice, of course, is not new in America. In August of 1963, what was the official name of the March on Washington, right? It was the March for Jobs and Freedom. So I'm hoping that we can see here now, more than 50 years later, that we're still not there yet. But there are things that we can do. And I want to talk with both of you about that when we come back. So we are talking this hour with Rana Faruhar and Michelle Singletary, two of our favorite economics analysts, about where the country is now. And hop on Facebook or Twitter at On Point Radio and let us know where you are economically, where you are regarding your employment, and the kinds of things that you'd like to see change in this country to lift everybody up. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we have brought back two of our favorite guests who talk about the economy. Rana Faruhar is with us. She's the global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times and also CNN's global economic analyst and author of several books, including Don't Be Evil and Makers and Takers. And Rana's with us from New York. And Michelle Singletary also joins us. She's the personal finance columnist for The Washington Post, and her column, The Color of Money, is syndicated across the country. And she's also author of The 21-Day Financial Fast, and she's with us from Bowie, Maryland. Now, Michelle, there's actually something that you said earlier in the show that I wanted to dig into a little bit more about homeownership rates and how the numbers haven't budged or have gotten worse. For African Americans, for example, I mean, there was a stunning. You had this sense in your voice that like it's unacceptable and shocking. But why? Tell me more about what those rates are and how they haven't changed.
So, in 1968, when anti-discrimination housing policies went into effect, the Black home ownership rates were around just shy of 40%. So in 2000, they peaked at 47.3% for Black Americans compared to 73% for white Americans. And so now we're looking at the rates. The last one of statistic for 2018, it was 41.7% compared to 73%. So you see there's no movement. And just before the housing boom, it nearly crossed the 50% mark, which all of us were watching like, yeah, go, go, go. And then the Great Recession happened. And we saw that there was so much predatory lending that it just rolled back any gains that African Americans were having in housing. And so when you look at the numbers, they've just been the same because a lot of the biases that were in place were not eliminated. There's appraiser to price, racism. For example, my home in Bowie, Maryland, if you picked it up, I mean, same kind of community, you know, single family homes, nice piece of land, you picked it up and moved it two counties over where it's majority white, and my house would be probably worth twice what it's worth. And what is the difference? Because the majority of people who I live around are African Americans. And so you saw it in lending practices that, you know, you couldn't get a loan in certain communities if you're African American. And if you did get a loan, the rate was higher. And same thing with equity. Our equity doesn't appreciate. So when you go to refinance, you know, if you pull, you know, equity out to do things like home, you know, improvement or some other things, like maybe you want to leave your home to your kids and they might want to sell it and move and buy their own homes. All of that is not equalized when you look at it between African Americans and white Americans. And a lot of those things are still happening. And again, we saw that in the Great Recession with the predatory lending. A lot of people was like, oh, those Black people, they were just irresponsible. They were buying homes more than they could afford. And when you look at the data, you saw that what happened was that an African-American with the same type of credit score, income, everything, you know, similar, they got a rate higher than a white borrower. And so that when things crashed, they crashed harder. Mm-hmm. And we saw all those things still in place during the Great Recession and still in place now.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, Michelle, no, that was just me, Rana, because one of the many questions that this pops into my mind is this also sort of points to the fundamental truth about how wealth is built in America, right? How family wealth is built in America and that it is predicated on home ownership. And
there's a pyramid. I mean, it's interesting. There's a kind of I think of wealth like a pyramid, and it starts with employment and decent wages, being able to have a job. You can build wealth. Then people tend to put it first, paying down debt, but then getting into home ownership. And then after that, you tend to get into stocks, equity ownership. And then at the very top of the pyramid is inherited wealth, you know, that you might get from your parents, being able to go to school debt free or being able to get a leg up as you graduate and start, maybe help with buying a home. That is something where there's a huge race gap in America. There was an interesting Brookings Institute study that was done in 2016 that found that the average white family had nearly 10 times the amount of net worth as the average Black household. And that's in part because whites have higher levels of inherited wealth. There's just that kind of that pyramid has been built up to a much greater extent. Also, white families tend to own equities in much higher rates. So about 60% of whites own some kind of equities as opposed to 30% of Black households. And that's interesting because that starts to get into policy and how we think about what government should be doing to encourage recovery and who's benefiting. So equities have really, really benefited in recent years from Fed policies, keeping rates low. We've done a lot of things, not just in the last 10 years, but I would argue in the last 40 years that have encouraged a boom in asset prices. We have not done nearly as much around home ownership. As a matter of fact, it was one of the terrible, terrible ironies of the great financial crisis was here you get this massive housing collapse. Banks get bailed out. Average homeowners lose their home. But then a lot of the homes that were being foreclosed upon were going to the courthouse steps, and you saw companies, big private equity companies, going in and buying them up dirt cheap.
That's right.
And then flipping them. You know, at one point, Blackstone was the largest single-family homeowner in America. So there are all kinds of things that we need to go really deep on in terms of racial and economic justice and how we think about the recovery and what we do going forward over this next year or two. That's going to be very, very difficult.
Can I just ask a quick point of clarification? When you're talking about that high percentage of equity ownership amongst white households, is that because of 401ks?
Yes, greater access to working for companies that offer retirement policies. And by the way, only about half of Americans actually have a 401k plan, have access to a 401k plan. I expect that number is actually going to go down because of the amounts of layoffs, the amounts of bankruptcies we're going to see in corporate America. A lot of small and mid-sized employers don't offer those. So, there's just a tremendous divide in terms of all kinds of economic security, the way we think about housing, the way we think about retirement plans. We haven't even talked about healthcare yet,
Right. And when you look at the domino, when you talk about it, so why don't we have money in the equities? Okay, so the jobs that we can get because we don't have a college degree, because the degrees cost so much, and we don't have the equity or the family money to send our kids to. So then the jobs that we get don't have 401ks. And it's not as if you can't save for retirement, but what we found in studies is that when you save through a 401k, you're more consistent about it because it's automatically taken out of your paycheck. And then there are companies who match that. So then you get money on top of that. So again, when we cite these statistics, and I know I'll get it in my email and I'll get it in my Twitter account, these racist comments like, well, you're just not as good, or you're not as smart, or you're not working as hard. But when you have all these systemic things going on that block you, and just remember, when I said 1968, that's within my lifetime it was legal to discriminate against me, both in jobs and housing and healthcare. And so all of that plays a part and why there is such a wealth gap. And we have to look at it all in totality, fix that whole, you know, when we talk about employment discrimination, discrimination when it comes to pay, we know that African Americans are paid less. We know women are paid less. Until we can fix that, and let's talk about the Fed. So they're keeping the rates down. Now, traditionally in the African American community, we don't put money in the stock market because, you know, we couldn't, first of all, and then we did. We're totally scared. We're more into, you know, real estate. However, if you're going to save, you can't keep pace with inflation because rates are so low if we did put money in a savings account, it's not going to keep pace with inflation.
Yeah, that's
so you got to connect all those dots when you talk about race. You got to connect the dots.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you need to start thinking about an entire economic system that shifts from one that we have now, which is about building up asset bubbles and encouraging and subsidizing debt, which helps create those asset bubbles, to one that rewards savers and encourages the buildup of income, fair wages, better jobs. And that's a big shift. Right. A lot of moving pieces there.
So, Rana, let me just ask you about the Fed. What do you think about the fact that it's aggressively maintaining those basically zero rates?
Yeah, you know, I don't think it's going to work. It's trying to solve the problems of debt with more debt. And that's what we've been doing for really since the 1980s. I mean, I've said this on this show before, but just quick recap. At that point in the 1980s, we shifted to a system that was basically about encouraging the markets. The markets know best, deregulate, encourage the buildup of asset prices, encourage corporate debt. We actually subsidized corporate debt and individual debt in many ways in the tax code. So that's why people take on mortgages that are bigger than they might otherwise do, because you can write off some of those interest payments. That's why corporations will take on a lot of debt, because you can get subsidized for that in ways through the tax code. The Fed really a lot gets put in the Fed's lap. I don't want to be too hard on central bankers because, I mean, I know most of them. They're good people. They are doing the very best they can in a difficult situation. But all of the Federal Reserve can do is encourage the inflation of asset prices and push money into the economy. It can't make people do productive things with that money. It can't make corporations invest in workers. It can't retrain a society to have the skills for a 21st century workplace. Although, interestingly, because we haven't had political leadership on those issues, you actually do see central bankers now in some regional feds like Boston and Dallas and Kansas City. You see them actually trying to go out now into the community and play that role. And they do have a mandate through community development to do that. But really, we are going to, and I pray to God, you know, after November, we're going to get a real national competitiveness strategy that starts to do what banks can't do, what politicians and companies must do together, which is think about what kind of economy do we want to have going forward? How do we create more resiliency, not focus on the short term, just make things as efficient as possible, outsource to the cheapest places, use software, downsize, don't think about human capital. We need to stop thinking about capital. There's plenty of that washing around the system. We need to think about human capital.
Michelle, we've got a question that's come in here over Twitter. Ross is asking, what macro-level policy levers would work best towards dialing down the disproportional inequity? On the tax side, slowing, I guess, the free flow of capital, I guess? There's an ellipses there, Ross says. I mean, Michelle, do you have any ideas?
I think on the macro level, when you're talking about home ownership, you know, more programs that will help people buy a home, In various communities, definitely looking at how equity is built up, looking at how homes are appraised. And I know people hate that idea of more regulation, but just really looking at the disparity. And macro, it sounds like a step back, but just looking at job creation. And job creation, that means that people can have a living wage so they can afford a house, so that they can build up equity and pass it on to generations. So that's what I would think, you know, looking at housing housing policies. There was a lot of rollback of community reinvestment issues in terms of, you know, where are bankers lending, looking more at the disparity in credit scoring, for example. You know, why is that there? Like, if more African Americans are renting, but that is not part of the look at how credit, because credit is all about debt. Well, if you don't have debt, you're just paying rent and your utilities, and that's not factored in, that means you will have a lower credit score. If you have a lower credit score, then your loan is going to cost more. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
That's what we need to look at. Yeah.
Well, Ron, I'm going to come back to you in a second here, but Michelle, there's actually a clip that I want to play that I'd love to get both of your takes on. This is Kimberly Jones. She's an author and an activist, and she had a video that she put out recently that went viral about economic inequities between Black and white Americans. So let's listen.
So if I played 400 rounds of Monopoly with you and I had to play and give you every dime that I made, and then for 50 years, every time that I played, if you didn't like what I did, you got to burn it like they did in Tulsa and like they did in Rosewood. How can you win? How can you win? You can't win. The game is fixed. So when they say, why do you burn down the community? Why do you burn down your own neighborhood? It's not ours. We don't own anything. We don't own anything.
Michelle, you want to respond to that?
Yeah. So all my relatives were passing along that clip as well. There's so much to unpack. I don't agree with burning down. I think that that's obviously not an answer, even if we don't own it. But you could hear the pain, and I'm going to tear up, because we know what it's like that you walk in the door and it's just the color of your skin that makes the difference of whether you get a job, whether you get a loan, whether you are treated on an equal ground. And that's the pain that you hear in her, that we want to forget that in our lifetimes, there were so many laws on the books that prevented us from owning businesses and homes and getting jobs. And slavery wasn't just 400 years ago. Those policies that kept a knee on our neck economically still exist. And I mean, I'm tearing up because I remember being in newsrooms that are supposed to be liberal and hearing white colleagues say things like, we weren't as good as the white interns. Then how can I move forward in my job with people who have those kinds of beliefs that somehow we are different? And so that's what you heard in her. The challenge for us when we do the protests is that we cannot do things that will allow people to deflect from our message. And so while I understand the anger of wanting to burn down, you can't do that, because I think Martin Luther King said we have to do it with peace. Mm. Because when we do things that seem criminal, it deflects from the basic message of this is unfair.
That's so interesting. You know, you're making me think of a number of things. I actually was quoting MLK to my daughter the other day because she came back from a protest and she had been very shaken about a couple of protesters that got pepper spray in their eyes. And she was very, very angry and very, you know, inclined to say, I want to throw a bottle. I want to, you right. know, I'm angry. And, but I said to her, I said, you know, fear is Donald Trump's oxygen, and mm-hmm. you don't want that narrative to shift. We need to stick with, correct. Really, it is the MLK narrative that we are in this together. I've been reading his last book. I know I'm hearing the music, but I've been reading his last book, and it's very interesting. It's all about economic justice and the moment that we're in right now, which I would love to come back to.
Well, we will do that when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we have brought back Rana Faruhar, Financial Times global business columnist and associate editor there, and also Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist for The Washington Post and author of the syndicated column, The Color of Money, to talk us through where we are right now regarding broad inequities in the United States, racial and economic as well. And Rana, before the break, you were about to tell us a little bit more about reading Dr. King's books.
Yeah, well, no. So I've been reading his last book, yeah. which is entitled Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? And the thing that really strikes me is that it could have been written yesterday in some ways. You know, it's about tackling basic income, wealth inequality in a united social movement that would deal with issues of both race and class injustice. You know, education, fair housing, higher wages, better quality jobs, all the things that we're talking about now. And I'm going to, even though we've talked about a lot of things that are very difficult so far in this program, I'm going to go out on a limb and say something that I am hopeful about, which is that when you look back at the civil rights movement and protests of the 60s, they were mainly in Black communities. They were being organized by civil rights leaders from African American communities. That's still the you know largely the case today. But you also see a very diverse and broad group of participants in also white communities, places like Boise, Ohio, Idaho, or Colorado. And so, to me, that's really hopeful. You know, that's, we're all getting on board. I mean, there's an entire younger generation, which, by the way, when you look at new workers coming into the labor force, we are already a majority minority workforce amongst new workers. So we're not quite there as a country overall, but there are these shifts that are just, you know, the arc of justice is bending in the right direction. So I want to be a little bit hopeful about
that. You know what? We all need to feel hopeful, or at least have a hopeful direction in which to want to travel. I completely agree. I would also say that it might actually be a little too easy to focus on this current administration as well, because all the, you know, the inequities we've been talking about this hour, just to state the obvious, have been with us for a long, long time, and they have been structurally strengthened. I mean, the inequities have been calcified structurally through policy decisions made across multiple administrations, multiple Congresses, by both parties, I would also say.
Yes.
And so what I'm wondering now is, Michelle, I'll first throw this one to you. Like, are we looking at a possible turning point where we can move forward? Because I think one of the best ways to attack these inequities is to attack the structure of the inequities, right? There are policy decisions that we can make that would lift people up in a meaningful way that could hopefully begin to close gaps. And it's, in a sense, I'm rambling here, but what I'm trying to say is that it might actually be easier, hopefully, to change policy than it is to change hearts and minds. So where would you point to? Where would you look? What would you try to start changing?
Well, ooh, that's a lot.
Yes.
I am too hopeful. We're having this discussion in my household all the time. My husband and I, my children. By the way, can I just throw this in? My daughter, Jillian, loves your podcast, Modern Love. She's listening now, and I just wanted to do a shout out because she's like, oh, I love her.
a young woman with exquisite taste. So
I tell you, this is true. So I think you're absolutely right. That it is going to have to be policy that drives it rather than, because to change someone's heart is just, it just takes generations. And I love what Rhonda said, that when we see the protests and we see that it's outside of our communities, meaning African American communities, that does lift my heart, because if we continue to march and we continue to pressure legislators, and again, it's not just Congress, we've got to do this on the state level as well. Mm-hmm. And so that's why when I see these protests states from state to state in communities that are not of color, I'm like, yes, because they're then going to press their legislators to change laws. We know that laws sort of bring people along to the right side. I mean, we would not have had minimum wage had not been for, you know, changing the laws. And so that's where it's going to have to happen. A lot of that deregulation that happened, we've got to put some things back in place. We've got to know the numbers. It's really hard to get lenders to produce numbers about where are you lending and what are you giving, you know, what kind of loans are you giving folks? And it's only through lawsuits that we sometimes get to see the disparity. I mean, let's just take buying a car. Now you think, well, how does this relate to all of this going on? Well, the second largest item in people's budgets is transportation, their car. And so we've seen through lawsuits that when African Americans go in, again, with similar income and credit scores, they get a higher interest rate on their auto loan, which means, of course, they pay more for it. That's less money that they have in their pocket to invest or help their kids go to college. So it's all, again, connected. And I think absolutely we got to keep marching right through November, and whoever wins the White House, you're absolutely right. A lot of things are still in place, but because we have the politics that we have, sometimes even when you have someone in the White House who is for change, they can't get it through Congress, right?
And I think, Megan, you're on to something, that this is a multi-decade shift that needs to happen. And I think I would, again, go back to from the 80s till, well, we thought it was going to be 2008 would be the change, but it may be now, 2020, that is the change. During that period, you had a big pendulum swing away from the public sector towards private sector wealth, away from an economy that was based on kind of relatively, no, I won't say equitable, gradual but more equitably shared income growth as opposed to an asset bubble that created wealth for the 1% and everybody else got left behind. I think now you're going to see a multi-decade shift in the opposite direction because that's what happens. When things move to an extreme, the system ultimately becomes too fragile and it crumbles. And that's exactly what these protests are illuminating right now. And I think that they're bringing together issues of race, but also class, in the sense that you have an entire group of young people now across the country that feels so burdened, underemployed, burdened by student debt. All those things are going to play into the election in November. But beyond that, let's say, you know, you're starting to be able to imagine potentially even a Democratic sweep. If you were to see that, I think that you may also see changes, bigger changes around things like higher minimum wage. I think you might see potentially a ban on right to work laws. You know, that legislation had actually already passed through the House. Right to work, you know, as I'm sure many listeners know, I find that one of these like Kafka-esque phrases, because basically it means it's harder to unionize. And I think that you may see some of those laws changing so that you can have a stronger labor movement, particularly in southern states where a lot of people haven't had access to collective bargaining. I think that you're going to see higher corporate taxes probably some stronger social safety net spending. I hope that you're going to see some kind of write-off of student debt. And, you know, I don't want to put too much on the table, but I think we're going to have to address healthcare. And I mean, if there's anything that this virus has illuminated, it's how fragile our healthcare system is.
Absolutely. You know, one of your followers, Ross, just tweeted something, and the last part of his tweet says, systemic breakdowns are not personal failures. And I love that sentiment, because we so often put it on the individual that they somehow failed, that you are in the position that you are in because of something you did.
Right.
And in my column, I wanted to just read a quote from Alana McCargo from the Urban Institute. And she said, this is not an issue of behavior. It is the inequity that is the problem. It's the same issue that resulted in that man holding his knee on George Floyd's neck. It's rooted in a long history of a system that has been working against people of color.
Mm-hmm. You know, If you hear me stumbling now, it's because
you're speechless.
I have a deep personal frustration about the political system in the United States, that so often looking for solutions is forced through the lens of partisanship, mm-hmm. because what we know for a fact is that the struggles of the American middle class, the struggles of people who are impoverished. I mean, it's not as if like bad times look for people only of a certain party. Do you know what I mean? And so the fact that our political system forces a truth that's hitting many, many millions of Americans, regardless of what they think about politics, it's hitting them in the same way. But then we're forced in elections to seek solutions through parties. It really bothers me. Okay. It really bothers me a lot, because I think it limits our ability as a nation to actually find ways to fix these systemic issues. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I want to play a clip for you just to get us back into where we are right now, about politics flowing through all of this. And this is, you're about to hear White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow. He was on CNN on Sunday talking about the fact that $600 that unemployed Americans are getting is going to stop at the end of July. And here he is explaining the White House's view.
It's better than their salaries would get. And that might have worked for the first couple of months. It'll end in late July. I think that returning to employment, we are in the administration, the president is looking at a reform measure that will still provide some kind of bonus for returning to work, but it will not be as large, and it will create an incentive to work.
So, Rana, you want to respond to that?
I just have such a hard time getting my brain around the thinking that people don't want to work. You know, I mean, yes. Everybody wants to work. I mean, and, you know, this is one of the issues I have with universal basic income is that I don't think it addresses the meaning of work question. Everybody wants a good job. Mm-hmm. Nobody is going to not want to have a career and work productively because they're getting a PPP check. I think that the bigger issue here is who's been first in line for most of the federal handouts, which has been largely big companies, which employ only 10% of the American workforce. I don't even know where to start with Kudlow. Let me just say that I think that the administration right now is doing something very dangerous, which is trying to underplay how serious the economic situation is at this moment so that they can try to get a reopening so that the numbers can look a little bit better in advance of November. And I think it's a strategy that is going to backfire. I think it's already backfiring. The virus is under control in some of the northeastern states, but it's spreading in 10 other states that are 40% of the population. Mm-hmm. I don't even know where to begin with how much I disagree with Larry Kudlow.
But we have a really good question following on from that. Robert on Twitter is asking, what would you say to critics of longer term systemic arguments, of the systemic arguments you're making here? Basically, critics who would say that it's a zero sum game that is going to cut into their piece of the pie, Michelle.
Oh, Lord. Where do I start with that? That is just such, there's more than one pie. And there is enough in America for everyone. And
yes.
When we talk about that, if I get a bigger piece, you're going to get less. And I don't want to sort of, you know, just, I think part of the reason why Trump was elected is that there was a lot of people who were suffering economically, who felt that other people, many times people of color, were getting more than they were unfairly. And so I totally did not like this idea of characterizing people who wanted to vote for Trump as idiots or racist. I think they were suffering, and when you're suffering, you look for someone to blame. And he was allowing them to blame people of color that we're getting more. And it's just not true. We're still not getting enough. I was in a newsroom, and I won't say which one, but one of my white colleagues was complaining about the increase in African Americans getting jobs. And he said, oh, you know, it's hard to be a white man in America. And I just was stunned. And I said, stand up, look around this newsroom. How many black people do you see?
That's good. Yeah.
Well, you know,
that's the sentiment that we have out there. There is enough people. We in America have more than so many around the world. And if someone gets a minimum wage job, that is not going to take so much from you that you can't succeed. Because if we all can succeed and have a decent living, we all benefit. So yeah, maybe it might mean that you can't get a third car or maybe a summer home. But if we have a society where people can live well and pay for their kids to go to college so they can live well. And whatever job that they choose, we all benefit from that.
Michelle, I would say that it doesn't even have to mean that people can't get a third car or a summer home. If we really want to interrogate the mass transfer of wealth, we could still, people could still get a third car or a summer home and there would still be enough for everybody. There's no question about it. Because I think one of the biggest problems is that most Americans, and I'll include myself in this, and even when I look at the numbers, it is hard to actually understand what it means when we see this ballooning of wealth amongst a minute fraction of people.
Right.
We can't even imagine what it means
anymore.
That's part of the problem here. There's no cutting of the pie question, because the pie is actually enormous. Now, right. I'm going to calm down.
And that message, by the way, comes from the people, that message of the pie comes from the people who have five times, a trillion times as many pies than we have. And, you know, look at the people who we've elected. They're millionaires. Like that comment about people who are on unemployment somehow that extra $600 is going to get, oh, well, I don't need to work anymore at all. That means that you have never, ever talked to someone who's been unemployed, that you have never stood in front of them looking at their budget, trying to figure out how to put food on their table with that unemployment check. So that is just that. Oh, my Lord, I'm so mad right now, because it just means that you are not talking to the people that you are making policies for, that we need to be able to secure people during this pandemic, because it will benefit all of us in the end. We'll all be economically healthy and just physically healthy, too.
Michelle Singletary and Rana Faruhar, come on back in another 6 weeks, okay?
Sounds good. Absolutely. Sounds good. Thank you for your time.
Thank you to both of you, as always. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.